Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of What's New in History. Today we have a special guest. It's Dr. Peter Brand, who wrote an awesome new book called Ramses II, Egypt's Ultimate Pharaoh. And the following is my discussion with Peter Brand. And I do want to take just a second to thank you, listeners, just for giving me the opportunity to be able to do something like this. When you hear me on this episode, I usually do trip over my tongue somewhat, but I was tripping over my tongue a little more than usual. I was possibly a little starstruck because this book was really awesome, and I was really excited to talk to Peter Brand. So here is our discussion. I hope you guys enjoy it. We are here today with Peter Brand. Is it Dr. Peter Brand?
Yes.
Professor Peter Brand? So Dr. Peter Brand.
The University of Memphis.
Yeah. In Tennessee, not in Egypt, right?
Not the Egyptian one, in the Tennessee one, yes.
Right. Because exactly. When I first saw it, that's why I was asking your time zone. I was thinking, well, maybe he's in Egypt. Since you are an Egyptologist, right?
Yes, I'm actually hoping to get there in March. I hadn't been there since before COVID, so it'll be nice to get back.
Oh, yeah, amazing. So, yeah, so basically, Dr. Peter Brand here, he has a new book. It's about Ramses II. It's Ramses II, Egypt's Ultimate Pharaoh. It's also known as Ramses the Great, isn't he?
Yes.
And I'm going to say, and I'm going to turn a lot of it over to you. I just, when I first got the message to do this interview, and then I got the book on a PDF, and it was like 600 pages, and I was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to get through this? And I got through most of the book in a week because it's a really well written and it's really interesting. And there's pictures, not to say I just need to look at pictures, but there's a lot of pictures. So, you know, kudos to you. It's a really good book. So, I mean, tell us about the book. Tell us about Ramses. Just start like that.
Yes. Well, as you say, you know, he is often called Ramses the Great. And of course, you might ask, well, why didn't I call the book Ramses the Second, Egypt's Greatest Pharaoh? Is because that name was taken. But part of the reason why I'm calling him the ultimate pharaoh is because over the course of more than 3,000 years, of course, there were dozens and dozens of pharaohs. But few stand out as much as Ramses II in terms of being the epitome of everything that a pharaoh is supposed to be. And of course, earlier pharaohs like Khufu, who builds the Great Pyramid, the great warrior pharaoh like Thutmose III, often called the first monotheist, Akhenaten, with his famous wife Nefertiti, or the golden boy king Tutankhamun, or perhaps sometimes even better known than Ramses, certainly in his own time and for hundreds of years after his death. During pharaonic times down to modern times, you know, he was Ramses the Great. And he really did epitomize everything that a pharaoh was supposed to be. He was a great warrior king. Among other things, he fought this famous battle, the Battle of Kadesh, against a rival empire the Hittites, who were occupying what is now Turkey and fighting over Syria, and in particular a city-state called Kadesh that these two empires had been vying for with each other for more than 60 years. And Ramses fought a famous battle there. And then recorded it in splendid detail with sort of this media blitz where he covered the walls of Egypt's temples with very elaborate battle scenes and a textual account that sort of is more epic poetry, celebrating his role as single-handedly supposedly defeating the enemy. Yeah. He was a great builder as well. And the interesting thing that I tried to focus on in the book that is not as well known is he was also a great diplomat and statesman. And of course, then finally, he also becomes, as the Egyptians call him, a great god. He transforms himself into a living deity on earth, a kind of incarnation of the Egyptian sun god. And while Egyptian pharaohs were all at least somewhat divine, and their parentage was considered to be divine, few mm-hmm. pharaohs ever actually ruled on earth as living gods the way that Ramses II did.
Well, that's, amazing. I mean, so in Ramses' time, we're talking, he was pharaoh from when?
Well, as one of my professors used to say, that far back, dates are like prices, they're subject to change.
Okay.
And so within the space of about 10 or 15 years, we can estimate, but the date I would argue is that he came to the throne in about 1279 BC, and he rules into his 67th year. He was probably in his early 20s when he came to the throne. And after ruling for just a bit over 66 years, he would have been in his as young as his mid 80s or as old as his early 90s. I suspect he was somewhere around maybe 87 or 89 when he died, which is still amazing. Impressive.
Yeah, right.
Almost 67 years, very few monarchs in all of human history ruled as long. I mean, even more recently, you think, of course, of Louis XIV, the Sun King of France, who comes to the throne as a child, or Queen Elizabeth, who just died last year. And of course, she was 96. So again, he's really quite extraordinary. The other thing you have to understand about longevity in the ancient times, the average life expectancy back then is about 35 years. So Ramses lives the equivalent of something like three lifetimes.
Yeah, right. He outlived most of his children, right?
Yes, and likely even many of his grandchildren, I assume.
Amazing. Not like the Sumerian kings who lived for like 27,000 years, though. This is like he actually lived this long. Yeah, so that's a long time ago for people. And you know what? I think what's interesting reading your book is that you have so much information from such a long time ago. You know, there's still a lot of written. This period, it seems like there's a lot of written, information. I do the podcast in a regular narrative. Sometimes I can't hardly find anything. I can hardly find anything on some decades, and you have so much information. There's so much in the book.
Well, we're very fortunate about, relatively speaking, for ancient Egypt, this period that he lived in, and even sort of this age, what Egyptologists called the New Kingdom, this period when Egypt was essentially an imperial power. From roughly about 1550 BC down to about 1100 BCE, during three dynasties, the 18th, 19th, and 20th, this is the golden age of Egypt's imperial power. And it's very well documented. When you're talking about thousands of years ago, though, one we have to understand that we only have fragments, really. And even somebody as well documented as Ramses II, very often the evidence is still rather fragmentary. I mentioned this famous battle he fought, the Battle of Kadesh. Well, we actually have a number of inscriptions, individual inscriptions carved on the walls of various temples across Egypt and even into Nubia in the south of Egypt. And despite this fact, the main textual record of that talks about the battle, we still have gaps in our knowledge of the text, because no example of the text is actually perfectly preserved. And in a few cases, there are passages where every single one of the examples that we have something are actually missing that one little bit. Now, overall, it's still very well preserved, and we've got more than 90% of it, but it's sort of an example of just how fragile our connection with ancient times is. And there's so many other documents that we only have one copy, and if that's damaged, then we're left guessing about what was really going on.
Right. And in that particular battle, there was, I mean, they're making up some lies as they, what you have written too, right? I mean, the Hittites say they won, and the Egyptians say they won. I particularly liked, and I didn't know until I read your book, is how he basically claims that he single-handedly, you know, fought the battle. And what I also thought was interesting, when I was reading it, I thought it was interesting that it's like a tradition that they write that the Pharaoh pretty much puts down his own army and says that, you know, they're a bunch of losers and they're a bunch of cowards, and I had to go in and do this all myself. That was kind of interesting.
Yeah, and this brings up one of the main themes in the book, which is that, like every culture, every civilization that has ever existed, the Egyptians had their own worldview. They had their own ideology. And their ideology placed the Pharaoh quite literally at the center of the universe. And his job was to essentially uphold the order of the universe against all forces of chaos. And of course, foreign peoples were considered agents of chaos and dangerous to the, you know, the order of the universe. But Ramses is often called, you know, again, in shorthand, a liar, or, you know, telling us an untruth, or, exaggerating things grossly. And there are definitely things that are not factual in his record. And it's easy to essentially call him a liar. One of the things that I try to emphasize is that because this ideological worldview was so central to Egyptian thinking, and the purpose of these records, these beautiful works of art, these elaborate texts, these intricate carvings on the walls of the temples, their purpose is not to narrate history. Their purpose is not to tell us as historians what happened. They are there to glorify the king and to demonstrate the ideological worldview of the ancient Egyptians. And so what really happened in historical accuracy is really a secondary importance to the Egyptians. What really matters is essentially celebrating this ideology of the Pharaoh as the champion of order against forces of chaos. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, when you consider Ramses again telling us things that just don't add up, like that he single-handedly defeated the enemies, or that the army were a bunch of cowards that deserted him in the middle of battle. When you start comparing it to the accounts of other pharaohs and their battles, the same kind of thing turns up. There's a pharaoh from a couple hundred years before Ramses, who's often considered sort of the Napoleon of Egypt, a guy named Thutmose III. And his battle accounts are not nearly as flowery as Ramses II. But he tells us that, of course, that he single-handedly defeated the enemy. And at one point, he also says that when he forced the enemy to retreat and to basically he routed them, that they would have instantly defeated the enemies, except that the army again messed up and they went and looted the battlefield. So you can find again the same theme, that the Pharaoh is the single-handed army of one who defeats all comers, and that the army is sort of along for the ride, and they're more likely to mess things up or to run away as cowards rather than actually helping the king. So in that sense, Ramses is no different than any other pharaoh.
You wonder if, like, you hope that the soldiers were illiterate. They didn't want to hear their fearless leader say they're a bunch of cowards, right? That's not the way to motivate people.
Yeah, but we have to understand that this is essentially the ancient Egyptian equivalent of spin.
Yeah.
Everybody knew what their role was. This was just the way they talked about things. Because again, Ramses never seems to have punished the army.
And yeah, right.
We know that the pharaohs were actually very careful to reward. And we have this beautiful inscription that tells us about how just this average soldier, a guy named Mos, received a reward along with a group of other soldiers from the pharaoh. And that Ramses gave them gifts of things made of gold and silver and bronze, these valuable objects. They didn't have money back then. So receiving these gold and silver and metal trinkets was a spectacular source of wealth. And he's showering these gifts on loyal soldiers. So again, he wasn't always berating the army.
Right, right. And that was just their way to write anyway. I mean, we know the Assyrian kings had their way, you know, they always looked exactly the same, and they were kind of single-handedly destroying people, and they're just a little more graphic on the stuff that they were doing.
And you know, it's interesting, if you look at the records of other civilizations, whether you're talking about the Assyrians or the Babylonians, the Hittites, the ancient Romans, the king always says, I'm the one that defeated the enemy, I'm the one that did this. So again, it's sort of the oldest story in the world that the boss takes credit for everything.
I could imagine we had a recent president that would have been something like that. He would have loved to have been able to write, I think, hieroglyphics on the wall and take credit for everything, but we're not political in this podcast. I was thinking about the army though, too, just a question it brought up. Like, were the soldiers from Egypt? I thought it was a thing, and my co-host Dan a lot of times says that Egyptians didn't want to leave Egypt because then if they die outside of Egypt, then it's not good. So could you tell me a little bit about that?
It's interesting because the Egyptians did have a kind of negative view of foreign peoples and foreign places. We have various kinds of literary texts that talk about how miserable it is to, you know, leave Egypt. We even have these texts that sort of poke fun at the miseries of a soldier's life and saying that, you know, you'll be marching overseas and your feet will get sore and you'll be attacked by bandits and you know, Bedouin. And even if you're a chariot officer, which is like a really, you know, sexy kind of job, you know, adventurous, it's like being an ancient equivalent of like a fighter pilot or a medieval knight. But the scribes write these things, you know, even if you're a chariot officer, all these bad things will happen to you if you go overseas and your chariot will crash and you'll be robbed and all this kind of thing. And so these literary texts that were used also to train the scribes played up how miserable it is to be overseas. And again, I'm sure for the average foot soldier and even for a king on campaign, there were hardships from growing abroad. But that didn't stop the Egyptians from fighting overseas. And in fact, they were doing this for not just centuries, but even millennia. From prehistoric times down into the end of pharaonic civilization, we have evidence that they would send their armies abroad. They didn't, on the other hand, outside of the Nile Valley, they didn't seem to want to settle abroad. So in the Nile Valley in ancient Nubia, which was to the south of Egypt, because it was the Nile Valley, I think they felt a bit more at home and they created a kind of colonial empire there. Whereas in the Middle East, you know, along, you know, what is now Israel, Lebanon and Syria, you know, they went there and they may have had vassal kings and expected to be receive tribute or fight wars. They didn't necessarily want to live there. It was a bit too,
So this period is basically the late Bronze Age, right? And I was interesting too, the history of, I didn't realize, and I've been studying history my whole life too, but I didn't realize his ancestry was, you know, Akhenaten was the first monotheistic, I guess, person. And that was, he's not related to, he had no children, right? So then Ramses' grandfather became a pharaoh, and there is a process for that to happen without being an actual blood relative, I guess.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. And in fact, Akhenaten, who again is often considered to be kind of the world's first monotheist, and there's a d- there are debates among Egyptologists about exactly what that means. Now, he did have at least one son who was probably the famous Tutankhamun.
Oh, right.
But Tutankhamun, on the other hand, did not apparently have an heir. In fact, they even found in his tomb the mummified remains of two stillborn fetuses that had evidence of massive birth defects. Mm-hmm. And so when he died without children, it was necessary to appoint one of the members of the royal court, one of the high officials. And in fact, you had this strange period of political turmoil where the next three kings were non-royals that were appointed to become pharaoh. And the first two of them, in fact, also died without having children. Then finally, Ramses' grandfather, whose original name was Piramisu, who was a vizier, a kind of Egyptian prime minister, and he was also a senior general of the army, was promoted to be the heir to the throne. And of course, he already had a son who was in vigorous adulthood, a man named Seti, who was Ramses' father. And so this Piramisu, who became Ramses I and Seti I, these two kings, they had served as high officials, they had served as generals, and they were, although Ramses I only rules for a couple of years or less than a couple of years, his son Seti, who is the father of Ramses II, has a very successful reign of about a decade and sort of sets the stage for Ramses II. But then is ultimately overshadowed by his famous son.
Sure.
So that not as many people know about poor old Seti. I did my dissertation on him. But if there was no Ramses II, everybody would be talking about Seti. But of course,
yeah, because that must have been quite a lot of turmoil at that period. You know, a lot of Game of Thrones stuff going on there. But then because they didn't have any heirs. And then when Seti was pharaoh, he set up Ramses as the, as the crown prince. And then he set him up with a couple of wives. And then, wow, Ramses had a lot of children, didn't he?
Yes. And that's the thing. One of the extraordinary things about Ramses is just how many children he seems to have had. And also the fairly large number of wives that he must have had. Now, these ancient pharaohs, and in fact, a lot of the other ancient kings, even Solomon in the Bible, or these Babylonian, Assyrian, Hittite kings, they were what we call polygamous. They had multiple wives and sometimes fathered probably very large numbers of children. But even among the pharaohs who were also polygamous, nobody seems to stand out on the same level as Ramses II.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And trying to account for every one of these kids is sometimes a bit of a detective work. But my best estimate at this point is we're talking about something like 48 sons and about 53 or 54 daughters. But it quite literally is just over 100. this doesn't necessarily mean this is even all the children that he had. These are just perhaps the ones we know about. And of course, the same thing happens.
That sounds funny, you know, when someone says, how many kids, you know, when a guy says, how many kids you have two that I know about?
Yeah,
he literally says, I have about 98 kids that I know about.
Well, of course, he knew about them, but we, of course, because, again, ancient records are fragmentary, we don't always know. And what's interesting, though, is the wives. He must have had several wives early on, even when he was a prince, and his father sets him up with a household. They call it a female household that he's given, comparable to the beautiful maidens of the palace. And one of the inscriptions tells us, and it tells us that Ramses, you know, and he was a teenager, so I mean, they gave him a bunch of young ladies and said, get busy, you know, didn't have to be asked twice.
Yeah, and, I guess not.
And of course, it was important for the king and the crown prince to actually procreate and ensure the continuation.
Right, especially from where they were coming from, all that turmoil with all those people that didn't have them. And then he did really come from a military family, so I guess we could believe in there's, you know, he was an actual, you know, he probably did go on campaign and he might not have single-handedly fought everybody, but he seemed like he probably knew what he was doing.
Yes, and in fact, both in terms of the traditions of the warrior pharaohs, is that we know that even before we have cases of princes that we hear about their military training. But of course, you know, the family of Ramses, before they became pharaohs, were actually a line of military officers. So
right.
It was both in the family tradition, but also for a crown prince of Egypt who would one day be a war leader as pharaoh, it was important to get the on-the-job training as a warrior. And we know this, interestingly, as well with Seti, that he carefully prepared Ramses to take his place and to do everything a pharaoh is supposed to do, including to be a war leader. And so we know that even as a prince that Ramses participated. Seti himself was no slouch on the battlefield. He fought a number of aggressive wars, and he seems to have brought Ramses along on campaign even when he was quite young.
Yeah, I definitely, you cover everything so well in the book. I have to say, it's like, it's very readable, but it's also, you could tell it's, I mean, if you want to know anything about Ramses, if you're doing anything, it's all in there. I mean, it's all footnoted, but it's not like reading I read a lot of history, right? But it's not like reading that. It's like reading an actual story. So you're definitely a good writer, and it's definitely an easy read, and there's a lot of information. I didn't get to it. I don't know, as I got through a lot of it, but you know, if you believe in the Exodus, which is a whole thing I don't really believe in, but, and we maybe talk about that. He's kind of sometimes thought of Ramses as the Pharaoh of the Exodus, right? If there were, I mean, you know, in common, I don't know, pop fiction, maybe something like that.
Well, I mean, it is one of these very hotly debated issues, and you know, among Egyptologists, or, you know, biblical scholars, et cetera, there are different viewpoints. The thing is we have evidence from Egypt that seems to corroborate some details, but only the very broad details of places that are mentioned in the Bible. So for instance, in the Exodus account, you have the reference to what are called the store cities of Pithom and Ramses. And these refer to actual places that are found in, you know, in Egypt. And in fact, the so-called city of Ramses is the capital that Ramses II built in the northern part of the delta, in the eastern side of the northern delta, at a place which he called Pir Ramses, the house of Ramses. Now, again, whether or not the Exodus happened, or that whether it happened in the way the Bible describes it, is another matter that, again, is fiercely debated. I essentially don't take a stand on that. It's not something I've sort of really focused on. But again, one can make arguments for and against the historicity of the Exodus. I like just to say that's beyond my pay grade. mainly focus on the Egyptian side of things. But there's one of the interesting things is that after Ramses, his successor, a man named Merneptah, in fact, has, as far as we know, the earliest outside of the Bible itself, the earliest reference to the ancient Israelites is found in an inscription from the time of the pharaoh Merneptah, shortly after the death of Ramses II, that refers to a group of people in Canaan as being the Israelites. And it's interesting mm-hmm. because it mentions this the Israelites, and their name is written in hieroglyphs, but it's clearly the name of Israel. But it refers to them not as, it refers to Israel not as a place, like a city or a country, but rather as a group of people. And we can tell this because of the way the name is written out in hieroglyphs. The Egyptians could distinguish with special hieroglyphs whether you're right. talking about a place or a city or a group of people. Now, again, whether that means that the Exodus must have happened under Ramses right. II or not, that's, again, very hotly debated. And I must admit, I don't take a stand on that. The latter part of my book, I do, though, talk a bit about the memory of Ramses from ancient times down to modern times and how he was rediscovered, you know, when Egyptology was born in the 1800s and they were discovering all these monuments and they deciphered the hieroglyphs. And already by about the 1850s, historians of the ancient world were pegging Ramses as the pharaoh of the Exodus. And ever since, he is usually considered to be, if anybody is, that he's the most likely candidate for the pharaoh of the Exodus. But of course, that depends on whether or not you believe the Exodus is a historical event. Now, the Bible doesn't feel the need to name the pharaoh by name. Right. It just calls him pharaoh. It right. doesn't matter what his name is. He's the pharaoh.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that is a whole other topic. I have a friend who, he has another podcast. It's the podcast of Biblical Proportions, and it Gil Kedron from Israel, and he covers it pretty, he really digs into the stories, and he could speak Hebrew too, so he understands how, you know, this story was actually, a lot of the story was written, he feels, about Nebuchadnezzar. You know, when they say Pharaoh's making us won't give us straw to make more bricks and things like that, it was really because possibly something happening during the Babylonian captivity, and then was changed over time, but that's a whole other story. And I also just learned how to pronounce, how do you say, I always said Merneptah, but it's pronounced differently.
Well, all of these pronunciations are rather artificial. I mean, Merneptah or Merneptah. I think an attempt to pronounce it how it might have actually been pronounced yeah. might have been Minapta or something, but even like Ramses, sometimes people say Ramses or Ramesses. I think it was pronounced something like Ramesesa, but it's a dead language. Yeah. Nobody's spoken it for thousands of years, and we're trying to reconstruct it. And so all the even the spellings of the names, this is all sort of modern artificial pronunciations. And if even an Egyptologist that knows Egyptian might go back into ancient Egypt and try to speak it, and they wouldn't understand.
Right, you have a terrible accent. Yeah. You get laughed at. So can you read hieroglyphics?
Yes, that's one of the main things I do. And I teach classes here at the University of Memphis reading historical texts. Because I'm not an archaeologist. I don't like dig holes in the ground. My job is recording monumental inscriptions and interpreting. Of course, the Egyptians wrote their history on these monuments. So reading and deciphering the inscriptions is how you essentially decipher the history of Egypt. And of course, one of the interesting things that always fascinates me, and I talk a little bit about it in some places in the book, is of course, because every culture rewrites their history, when the Egyptians rewrote their history, they rewrote the monuments. And Ramses in particular sometimes also gets a bad rap for his what we consider rather bad tendency to erase the names of earlier kings on monuments and statues and reinscribe them with his own name. And this to us strikes us as almost like he's stealing credit for other people's works. And again, he gets a rather bad rap, but if we understand this from the perspective of ancient Egyptian civilization, this reuse of monuments and even their view of history was just different from our own. And so this was quite, from the Egyptian perspective, was actually perfectly a legitimate thing to do.
So how did you learn how to read hieroglyphics? Is that really, does it take a long time? Is there a lot to it? I mean, yeah. Imagine not many people do it, so it's quite difficult.
I mean, we here in the University of Memphis, for instance, or where I study also in the University of Toronto, it's the kind of thing the graduate students are like, you know, master's and doctoral students. It's not usually something that undergraduate, you know, four-year college students are doing, although it's possible. It is a dead language. You're not learning how to speak it. You're learning to decipher it. The hieroglyphs, you know, all those little picture signs, people think that's the hardest part. Part of it is just being able to understand the grammar and the phraseology of an alien language that is different from our own. And then, of course, reading texts from a culture that is also very different from our own. And you can learn the basic rules about how to read Egyptian texts probably, you know, in a couple of years, even after, you know, a few months of study, you can begin to read your first texts. But on the other hand, as one of my professors said, that, you know, it can take 10 years before you might feel fully comfortable reading these texts. So it is something, you know, that is a process.
And so, and Ramses did put a lot out there. A lot of it is on stone and marble and things like that. Is there papyrus too?
Yes, there the kind you know, when I wrote writing about the pharaoh, and most of the documents that I translate in the book are actually these monumental inscriptions. These are things that are literally carved in stone on the walls of temples, on these giant statues and obelisks, on these stone tablets where they used to essentially make announcements, called stele. It's like a tombstone. An upright slab of stone with inscriptions on it is a stele. And they used it as sort of like billboards or announcement, where they would set these things up to announce, you know, their glorious deeds. Those kind of things are written in the hieroglyphic script. On the other hand, on papyrus, they would write things that had to do with religious texts, but also everyday texts that, you know, administrative, or if you wrote a letter, even things like, you know, love songs and laundry lists and poetry and just post-it notes. And again, if you're, they even had a special cursive script that was just for writing text quickly, because I mean, if you're trying to write, you know, your shopping list, and you spend all day drawing these beautiful little hieroglyphs, you'll never get done. And so instead, you know, they did it with ink on papyrus or little flakes of stone or pottery, just very quickly in pen and ink, and it just looks like, you know, it just looks like calligraphy. And even those are different types of text, for, you know, compared to the kind of official pronouncements that are carved on the walls of the temples or on giant royal monuments.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that they did it, because we have so much information because they did do that. I mean, it's funny, even like, you know, you could take things from the Middle Ages in Europe. We don't have information. We have so much more information from something so further back.
Yeah, we're lucky on the one hand, all these inscriptions that were written in stone, that obviously it's very durable. I mean, the Egyptians used to call stone construction the good work of eternity. And one of the types of names they had for the temples that they would build were called mansions of millions of years, because again, they considered to be, you know, something that would last forever. And of course, it has lasted for, you know, three millennia in the case of Ramses. On the other hand, we do have a lot of papyrus, only a fraction of what the Egyptians ever created. But compared to other places in the world, because the deserts of Egypt are so dry, when these papyrus documents made their, you know, put in a tomb or buried in some place in the desert, they have often managed to survive, although the vast majority were not stored away in a dry place. and they have long since disappeared. But again, because of the environment of Egypt, otherwise very fragile documents written in papyrus have survived in relatively large numbers.
Isn't it recently, did you see it, that they found, I think it was like, is it 50 meters long roll that they found just recently in a Book of the Dead, I think?
Oh, that wouldn't surprise me. That was the one of the thing. Of course, they made scrolls and they would make these very long sheets or paste them all together. And yeah, there are some scrolls like that. I've never seen one myself that is that long, but I've seen them to go on for yards and yards.
Amazing. So the book, I could say how long did it take you to write it? Probably your whole career, because in some ways, you know, you've been learning it all the time, but just, you know, just what made you start it and how long did it take you? That kind of thing.
When I finished my doctoral studies back in the University of Toronto in the late 90s and published my book on, it's a very scholarly, it's not nearly as fun as this book is, but on this Pharaoh Seti, in 2000, I thought, well, you know, I want to write a book about Ramses and do some, I toyed around with the idea. I've done a lot of scientific, you know, studies, you know, very technical stuff. But I said, you know, I want to make something that's more accessible, you know, explain what I do and why it matters. One of my undergraduate mentors in the history department in the University of Texas, you know, said that good history is good literature. You know, it should be readable. Yeah. And you know, Egypt's so fun. It's interesting. And Ramses, he has a great story. And I wanted to tell this story. And so a lot of it is just, you know, working to craft a narrative and to, you know, make it interesting.
I mean, it is that. It's definitely well written and it's, but you have it footnoted too. So, I mean, it's both. You could see it's a lot of work. I mean, just sometimes I look at the footnotes and I think I would be so tired if I had to do all this work. So really, I mean, what's your process like? How long do you write and that kind of thing?
Well, part of it is, I mean, I have actually learned a lot about writing from working on this project. I mean, good writing, making it interesting, making it accessible, and just, you know, writing is, you know, good literature as opposed, I mean, scholarly writing, it's so easy because you just can, you know, go on and on, you know, in a dry tone that nobody really, but I mean, if you want to sell the book, if you want people to be interested and not put it down after reading a paragraph, then that's the hard part.
Yeah.
I guess I give popular lectures and that. And I had a friend in grad school that actually worked for a Canadian broadcasting company and basically taught me a lot about how to tell a good story. And so that's what I tried to do. And a lot of the time that it's taken, I've been working on this probably for about 10 years. A lot of it is actually working through to craft that narrative and to make it as accessible and as interesting without being cheesy, hopefully, but also
not cheesy, but just all the footnotes and all the details to prove everything you say. It's not like you're Graham Hitchcock, you know, and you just say like, hey, aliens or Atlanteans built the pyramids and all this nonsense with zero evidence and then make fun of people who don't, you know, who do the evidence. It's like, so aliens did not build the pyramids, right? We know that.
Not so much.
Drives me crazy. Does it drive you crazy? Because it just drives me crazy, that stuff.
Oh, well, you know, it's just, you know, to each his own, I suppose. I don't lose too much sleep over it.
Right.
Although I did debunk one sort of weird little theory that goes on.
Book?
Yeah.
Tell us about that, because I know what you're talking about.
There's an inscription in this temple at a place called Abydos in southern Egypt. It was a temple that I knew well because it was built originally by Ramses' father, King Seti. It has these beautiful carvings, really exquisite, very fine carvings that Seti was making. But unfortunately for poor old Seti, he didn't quite live long enough to fulfill all his giant building programs. And when he died, his son Ramses completed the temple. And there were places where, and again, this was something that often happened in ancient Egypt, especially in this period, is that there were places where Ramses carved over inscriptions that had already been carved by his father. And it was nothing personal. Again, it wasn't some vendetta mm-hmm. or, you know, attacking right. dear old dad or anything like that. But because of, there's this inscription that shows an overlapping set of hieroglyphs. And it's sort of like a word jumble. Imagine, you know, when your printer prints two lines on top of each other by accident. It's sort of like that, except with hieroglyphs. But of course, these are pictures. And, you know, when you overlap these things, they make these little suggestive shapes. And one of the shapes these overlapping hieroglyphs made to some people is what they thought they saw was a helicopter. And then they looked at some other things and they thought they saw everything from a hovercraft to a jet, or maybe it's a submarine. One point they said, maybe this is like a glider. One of them one of them looks like the land speeder from the original Star Wars. Oh, yeah. but it's all a jumble of hieroglyphs. And I showed and of course, people focus on this little bit.
Right.
Has these suggestive shapes. Now, there are other things that just don't add up. There's strange shapes nobody can explain. And there's the rest of the inscription. So one of the things I do with a nice diagram and explaining all this, you know, that it's sort of like when you see shapes in the clouds.
Yeah.
Or you get a potato chip that looks like, you know, a person or something like that. But I mean, those cloud dragons, you know, that you see floating across the sky are no more real than this helicopter at Abydos. But the human mind wants to see familiar shapes and strange objects. And of course,
TV shows and I guess
movies. Yeah, of course. The conspiracy theorists like to say, you know, you're suppressing the real knowledge. As an Egyptologist, I get these emails like at least once a month, sometimes once a week, from people. They've got a new theory about how the pyramids were really built. Or I had this one guy that was kept sending me these pictures that were like apparently of satellite images that were with these strange color coded. And he was convinced that he was discovering a series of gigantic statues buried around the world of giant animals. Just bizarre stuff. And after I got a couple of these, and I said, well, I tried to explain this, that, oh, you know, our minds work this way. It's just like we see familiar faces and inanimate objects, or we see
right.
you know, things Mars. In the clouds and this kind of thing. Right. And he writes back and says, so how much do they pay you to tell me?
Oh, that? My God.
And it's like, dude, they do not pay me nearly enough for that. No, they do not pay me.
I know.
I don't get paid to debunk, you know, your nonsense. But, you know.
Crazy. So, wait, now I do want to ask you, though, how were the pyramids built? I mean, I think we kind of know now, don't we? Because whenever somebody tells me and I say, that's not how, we know how they were built. But I don't, you know, just tell us quick, maybe, because I know it's not about Ramses.
Well, all these ancient monuments, they didn't even really have cranes. It's sort of almost like additive printing. You set the foundations down. You know, you clear a site where you're going to build a pyramid. You bring in the first layer of blocks and set them into place. And then they used rampways that were made from mud bricks and field stones and that. And you drag the next layer of blocks up this ramp and lay them into place. And then you raise the ramp, extend it. And as you go, you just keep extending the ramp, raising the ramp, and bringing the next layer of blocks up. And when you finally built the building, it's, you know, it has these rampways. With the pyramids, scholars debate the shape of the ramps. How many ramps were they entwined? But everybody knows basically that's how this was done. Now, of course, you say, well, where are the ramps? Well, you wouldn't leave the ramp when you're finished. It's like a scaffolding. There are, however, there's one pyramid that it's actually when they smoothed the blocks down when they were finishing the pyramid, you could actually sort of see this little shadow, like a groove where the ramp probably was.
Oh, okay.
And then there, like right next to the Great Pyramid, there's a smaller a tomb of a high official. It wasn't nearly a fraction of the height of a pyramid, but it actually has one of these rampways still attached to it. And then where I work, recording inscriptions at the Temple of Karnak, there's one of these tower gateways that actually has the remains of one of these mud brick rampways. And finally, okay, we have artistic scenes in Egyptian tombs that actually show these ramps that are used to build these monuments. So there's really no question that this is how they did it.
I mean, not helicopters then.
No helicopter, no levitation, nothing like that.
Sound, none of that. Yeah. Well, so the book, back to the back. Sorry, I just had to ask you that. So now I have at least a recording of it. Someone I get to say to the, you know. So back to the book, though. So is it ready yet? Is it out? Is it published? It's almost.
Yeah, it's actually being printed as we speak in Lithuania.
Nice.
And so it should be finished at the printers very shortly, and then of course it has to be shipped to the States. So I'm hoping that, you know, sometime in if not by the end of February, then into March, that it will actually appear, and it's going to be available as the hardcover is rather expensive, but the softcover we tried to keep it as low as possible, and it'll also be available in ebook format.
So if I go into Borders or a bookstore, will I maybe see it?
I'm not sure about a lot of the bookstores, but it'll certainly be available online. And some, I know there's some museum bookshops and this kind of thing that will make it available. As I say, some of these kind of books, when you still go to these bookstores like Borders, to the extent they still exist anymore,
right,
you know, the selection of ancient history books is usually pretty thin. Because that's the wonderful thing about Amazon and everything, is you can just get any kind of books there. And so it'll be there. And
But this is not just a text. This is not a textbook at all. This is a book for any person, a history fan, a lay person that wants to read. There's a lot of pictures in it, but you know, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to read some multiple audience. On the one hand, you know, it's hopefully of use to students that are learning about history and ancient Egypt and ancient history. For, you know, it is the first major new English book, you know, a broad look at Ramses II that is sort of an original work. There was a guy, sort of one of the masters of the field of Egyptology in the time of the Ramesside kings, who wrote his biography of Ramses back in 1982.
Okay.
And it was much briefer, but nobody had really, in English, there's a, in a French book, I think, but that had really done a new serious account of Ramses really since then. And so I know there are some popular books out there, but some of them even will say, oh, you know, I just followed what Kitchen said, this fellow Kenneth Kitchen, writing back in the early 80s. So I've worked with these sources. I've studied these inscriptions. Most of the translations of these hieroglyphic texts in the book are actually my translations, translated directly from the glyphs. Even some of the artwork of the inscriptions and the scenes in the temples and that kind of thing is my own.
Oh, you drew them. I know you're. Yeah, they're very detailed.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm gonna take some time now because I really just started to read it like a week and a half ago, and like I said, I really got through a lot of it because it's so well written. But I didn't get a chance to like peruse the pictures, and of course, I'm reading it from a PDF, so I don't have the book. So as soon as it comes out, I would definitely gonna get myself one. Put it right on the coffee table so all my guests could read about Ramses.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
And I don't want too many spoilers because people should read the book, but I mean, maybe wrapping it up. So Ramses was in his 90s when he died, and he outlived most of his children. Right, so Merneptah.
Yeah,
he was about 70 years old when he became the pharaoh, right?
Yeah, I mean at the very least he was somewhere in his 60s. I mean, it can be hard to estimate the age at death.
Yeah.
I mean, unlike so many historical figures, we actually have the bodies of a number of these pharaohs, including Seti and Ramses and Merneptah. But just because you have a body doesn't always make it possible to know exactly how old they were when they died. So again, it's sort of educated guesswork. But yeah, Merneptah must have been himself in his mid-60s and maybe even in his 70s. But he apparently inherited the genes that kept his father alive.
Like Prince Charles. But worse, because he wasn't even the crown prince. It was so many others until he became.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. I mean, Ramses outlived so many, including the first. And this doesn't mean there weren't younger sons as well, but the first 12 of his, the oldest 12 sons he had died before him. I mean, one of them had been his eldest son, firstborn son, was crown prince for about 20 years or so. The second one, who was also named Ramses, I call him Ramses Jr.,
because he doesn't have a number, right?
He didn't become pharaoh, so he never was Ramses III. It was actually 100 years later. There was a guy that was eventually called Ramses. We call Ramses III. But poor old Junior, he had the job for the better part of 20 to 30 years. But again, he died before his father. And so it was Merneptah that managed to outlive the old man, as it were.
Amazing. And then this is basically kind of like, this is sort of a swan song of the glory of Egypt, right? Because we have the Bronze Age collapse, not too much longer after that. And then...
Yes. Well, the end of, I mean, some, you know, it's a process, but, you know, between about 1200 and 1100 BC is this century that people talk about, you know, the end of the Bronze Age. Now, I mean, these kind of big events in history, it's hard to sort of pin it down. And of course, back then it was news to them. If you said, it
right.
was like, you know, they went woke up one day and said, oh my God, the Bronze Age is over. What do we do now? You know, it wasn't like people woke up in Florence, Italy in 1400 and said, holy, you know, it's the Renaissance.
You know? I know, but, exactly. You're right.
But I mean, on the other hand, this was a cataclysmic kind of, transition, at least for these large empires. You know, Egypt lost its overseas, you know, imperial territories, which I guess is great for the people that were under Egypt's
right.
thumb. You know, it wasn't so great to be a subject of an empire. The Hittites, this great civilization that had been Egypt's enemy, and then of course Ramses had made peace with them. They went down the tubes. Other empires and even other civilizations that weren't quite empires also went into decline. But there were some other groups that actually did quite well, including a group that became known in the Bible as the Philistines, and yeah. also the Israelites, of course, who had been this minor people in Canaan in the time of Merneptah. Of course, would then carve out the kingdom of Israel, and they were the ones that sort of inherited or filled the vacuum, at least in Canaan, after the collapse of all these Bronze Age empires.
Yeah. Well, I think that about covers it, don't you think?
Oh, there's lots more.
I'm sure there's lots, but I mean, for us to talk about it, because I really, like I always say when we do the podcast, no spoilers, because I mean, of course, we missed a ton of things. How many pages is the book? About 500, 600 pages?
Yeah, I mean, there's also, I will say, there's also a good index. That's one thing I always tried to do. And there's also several pages of a useful, what I call a glossary, which is like, if you hear me talk about Hattusili III or a palimpsest and you have no idea what that is or who the god Thoth is, I have a little handy guide in the back that sort of gives you definitions. And the other thing, one last thing I wanted to just say, that another focus of the book that is not really done in detail, except in very specialized, often foreign, like German publications. One of the big stories about Ramses I tell that even a lot of Egyptologists are not as familiar with, is his role as a diplomat, a very canny statesman, and his negotiations with the Hittites. And he got into this wonderful correspondence with the queen of the Hittites, a woman with this rather impressive name of Pudukepa. And they bartered for a bride because he wanted to marry a Hittite princess. And the Hittite queen basically drove a very hard bargain in the negotiations and was perhaps the only person that basically told Ramses what, in no uncertain terms, what she thought of him, and basically made his ears burn. And it's a fun story.
It's, you know, I just like maybe an hour before we started talking, I caught that part of the, and I was just going through, and I didn't have time to go through it all. So I mostly just read her stuff, but he is amazing. So the way she writes to him, and they're going back and forth, and he's bartering over, don't you have enough money already, and stuff like that. It was great. Really good. Yeah, I recommend this to any fan of history. I mean, you know, you got to at least know what ancient Egypt is. I have friends who don't, you know, they think that I know all this stuff, that I'm not a tenth. I don't know a tenth that Dr. Brand here knows. But, you know, if you're any kind of listener of this podcast, I think you will definitely enjoy this book. I'm going to tell my friend Cy, History But Cy, he's a big fan of Egypt. And, you know, he does these YouTube videos. He's more popular than me, but he'll definitely like this too. I'm going to maybe Cy will get you that for your Christmas or your birthday.
Sure. And I've actually done a few things on YouTube from public lectures that I've done. In fact, I just recently did one about Tutankhamun, who, along with Ramses, was one of my great interests in Egypt, even since I was a kid, you know, King Tut's gold. And in fact, that's what the talk is about how gold was used in King Tut's tomb. That's another.
Yeah, because I think you and I are about the same age. And I think I remember when we were kids that isn't in. They had King Tut was on tour, wasn't he?
Yes. I was actually once supposed to see him, but we moved shortly before the exhibit came, and it took me years before I finally got to Cairo and to be able to see King Tut's treasures in person.
That's amazing. Yeah, I would love to go to Egypt someday. It's safe to go, I imagine. I mean, people,
you know. I think so, absolutely. And, it's a good time to go, and it's the Egyptians are very hospitable people. They're very friendly. It's a great place to see. And there are all these sites. There's new sites being opened up. We're all waiting for this giant new museum, this sort of super museum. It's called the Grand Egyptian Museum. That's opening right next to the pyramids in Cairo.
Amazing.
It's going to be amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I saw that in your book, right? It's like $300 million investment they're putting in this. Something like that, or maybe I'm thinking of something else. That's in Athens. I just read in Athens they're building one too.
Yeah, but this is, they said, the largest museum dedicated to any one civilization. I mean, you could mistake it for an aircraft assembly plant. It's absolutely huge. Yeah,
they're going to want some of their stuff back, I think.
Well, it's going to be incredible. And of course, they'll put the Tut stuff there. But the centerpiece, of course, getting back to my friend, is that the foyer to the museum is one of these giant colossal statues of King Ramses that's in the museum. Yeah.
Amazing. So, yeah, the name of the book, right, is Ramses II, Egypt's Ultimate Pharaoh. You'll be able to get it on Amazon for sure. And probably certain bookstores, but definitely on Amazon. And I will, I'll put some links in the podcast notes. I'll put if you send me any links to anything you want me to put in there, I'll put in the podcast notes so people can know where to get it. If you have a website, that kind of thing.
Yes, I can do that.
And did I miss anything? Anything else you want to tell the listeners?
Oh, well, I hope you enjoyed the book.
Yeah, I think they will. Yeah, well, thank you for doing this podcast with us and What's New in History. I'll just say real quick to our fans, if you could check out our Facebook page, check out our Patreon, share this episode, share any episode, but especially this one, with your friends and enemies. And I thank you very much again, Dr. Peter Brand, and your book, Ramses II, Egypt's Ultimate Pharaoh. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/fanofhistory. Just $1 an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.